In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. We hear the first interview with Professor Eric Larson. This interview was done live in studio in September of 2011. In the second half hour, the phone lines open up to New York callers. At this time, Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11, had recently been published. It was an important time. Many were beginning to learn about her work. Let's have a listen. Today we speak with Professor Eric Larson. He's the author of many books, including A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Great Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. The time to be polite is long gone. We've been insane with blindness. We've been insane from the start not to see that 9/11 was the sheer fraud that it was, a murderous and purposely self-inflicted wound delivered to scare us mental defectives into total acquiescence. No, it was embraced with total eagerness. That is some of what you'll see on one page of Professor Eric Larson's book, The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Great Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. Why is this important? According to Professor Larson, clear exposure of the truth about 9/11 is the only way to stop the wholesale plunder and destruction in the United States. Is that possible? Every day, hopeful hearts and minds tune into progressive media sources and trust the content is sincere and honest. Professor Larson says even those media outlets have gatekeepers. It's not news to listeners, but acknowledging the people who continue to cover up the reality and truth of what happened on September 11, 2001, is the first step to break free of the systematic takedown. Professor Larson describes the subtle and creepy cover-ups in the progressive media and intellectual circles that continue to imprint itself into history. There is a level of censorship within progressive media, just as advertisers will pull their support from commercial media outlets based on certain content being broadcast. How would the hearts and minds that trust progressive media, such as the New York Times and National Public Radio, respond if they were aware that their trusted source of information is manipulating them, broadcasting half-truths and full-blown lies? Well, we talk more about this with Professor Eric Larson. He's the author of many books, including A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, and The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Great Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. Professor Larson, welcome to the show.
Very happy to be here, and thank you for having me.
Do you think it is important that the truth about 9/11 be acknowledged nationally before any kind of end to a systematic takedown of this country begins?
I do. I do very much. There also are, as it were, almost levels of untruths. That is to say, for many, still, one untruth is that 19 young Islam men with box cutters were the perpetrators of the destructive events of 9/11. And now there's also, of course, another level of truth, which is to say that it's not questioned as to whether or not 9/11 was done by outsiders as opposed to by insiders, but how it was done. And I think that the how has become the most important question. It has now been, in my view, proven what happened. That proof has come through the work of Dr. Judy Wood and her new book, not so new now, but still new, Where Did the Towers Go? The Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. But without those two levels of truth being addressed and resolved. I think that we are essentially lost, and we never will be able to recover our existence as a free democratic republic, ever. And then for me too, perhaps equally, it's a concomitant idea that we also are never going to be a nation of any kind of greatness again in the arts or in our cultural lives. And I'm a novelist first and became a writer of nonfiction when I couldn't get my novels published anymore. And that's what led me to write A Nation Gone Blind and subsequently The Skull of Yorick. But if I can't get my novels published, something's wrong. The thing that's wrong is that the country insists now that its literature also lie. It's the literature that can be published by commercial presses now, not always in the case of nonfiction, but very largely so, and certainly in the case of fiction, it must lie. And it must lie by omission, if not by commission. And the lie has to have its roots in 9/11. The lie is that we are a nation at war against enemies who are, in fact, real enemies, whereas, in fact, as far as I'm able to tell, and I think I'm right, that the enemies have been created by our own inventors, and the wars that we see fit to fight in so many places now, as a result of the launching pad of 9/11, these wars are self-created by us. So these lies are huge, and they can't continue to exist except with the great lie of 9/11 as their foundation.
I wanted to ask here, in your opinion, what is it that left-leaning hosts and progressive media want people to think about 9/11? And in light of the consequent wars, torture, do they really want their listeners and readers to think it's a coincidence?
You know, I have no idea what they want. I can easily imagine that a great number of people lie, primarily by omission, in the cases of what we call, what I call in the book, the left gatekeepers. Many of them, I'm sure, are frightened, and for their families, their jobs, their well-being, their prestige, their stature. This is one of my points, though, that lying, whether those are the reasons or not, lying is a disease, and it hurts you. It poisons you. Somewhere, I think it's either in Joseph Conrad or in King Lear. I know that King Lear says, I think it's Canty tells not to kiss his hand because it stinks of mortality. And somewhere there's a quote about lies. I think maybe it's at the end of Heart of Darkness, but I haven't been able to find it, where Conrad tells a story and his Marlowe is his narrator. And I thought that there, in the end he lies a little bit to the woman back in Belgium, giving her some hint, that, or some hope, as it were, that maybe her husband died nobly when he didn't. But and then I thought that there was a reference there to his wishing that he hadn't done that because it has about it a scent of mortality. And so if we continue to lie and tell untruths and pass them off as truths, we're going to pay for it, just as a person would pay for exposure to the toxic dusts at the Ground Zero on 9/11. We'll pay for it with their health and then with their lives. That's a physical, literal example, but lies, I believe, function the same way.
Now, in your book, The Skull of Yorick, it's a really powerful read, and it's amazing when you start to read the passages that you pull out from people such as Frank Rich. Mm-hmm. It's subtle. If you're reading along and trusting the information, you won't see that. It'll just pass right into the mind. Mm-hmm. But you've stopped sentence by sentence here, and you found some very interesting distortions and lies, but you have to look for it. Can you describe some of that work that you've done in this book?
Sure. In 2006, when I published A Nation Gone Blind, I created a website, and I began to write these articles and posting them on my website. And as I learned more myself about 9/11, I began to read more, obviously. And one of the things, I read many, many books by scholars of the event and historians of it, but also began reading the more everyday journalists, Frank Rich, Dwight Garner, others, who wrote about it. And I found myself face to face with the fact that they were lying. And these lies indeed were subtle often. And I think you've pointed out something very, very profound, which is to say those deceptions are... I tried to avoid too much very harsh language. Now that we've had harsh interrogation, I don't want to have harsh language. But I remember one point in the book, and I thought, well, I better not just say... I had written that Frank Rich is lying like a rug. And so on the advice of a friend, I changed it, and I said, Frank Rich is dissembling like a rug. I very much care for that phrase. But the trust you mentioned, the readers of Frank Rich, and I was one for years and still am, but they're very trusting readership. And a figure like him is valuable to the places that he works for and writes for, partly because he has that following. And it's just true of any kind of commentator or journalist who does that kind of weekly, biweekly, monthly, daily, whatever it may be. Without a trust in the readership, or the readership's trust in the writer, a great deal is going to be lost. In fact, the readership will diminish. On the other hand, that trust can be abused. And I thought in the pieces, I have this two-part essay in here called The Pernicious Hypocrisy of Frank Rich of the New York Times. That one's from fairly far back, I think 2007. More recently, I've written about a piece in the last chapter of the book. It has a great deal to do with Frank Rich again and with Don DeLillo, and an awful piece that Frank Rich did for the Book Review. It was on the cover of the Book Review. I have the date. I can't put my finger on it now without looking. But he wrote such an extraordinarily unleashed, adulatory piece about DeLillo's third-rate, if not fourth-rate, book, Falling Man, that I was just absolutely puzzled. How I went immediately, as I always do with the Times. If somebody writes a negative review, I go get the book because it's probably going to be good. And if they write too highly laudatory a piece, I'm suspicious, and then I go read the book, and it's usually bad. And in this case, the DeLillo book is just awful. It's just terrible. And what it does is follow every single thread and almost every molecule of the official story about 9/11, of the 19 box cutters, Muhammad Atta, being a drinker and a consorter with lap dancers and so forth. It's done to just a pack of dissemblings, and a very cheap one too. Not a good book, not an honorable book. And I believe that what Frank Rich must have loved so much about it was that it hewed to the big lie. And DeLillo is famous, and therefore Rich could adulate a major novelist's book that toes the official line. Well, that raised my suspicion enormously. So I went back and reread. I always had wanted to write on the Frank Rich piece, that review. And I finally did it. And it's here. Now,
it's here in the book titled The Skull of Yorick.
That's right.
And the subtitle is The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Grave Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. And again, our guest is Professor Eric Larson, the author of this book and many others.
I think that something else occurred which helped me hone my reading, as it were, of some of Frank Rich. Not all, by any means, although there's a good handful of his Sunday pieces that I wanted to write about and didn't. I guess I must analyze a couple of them closely and allude to three or four others. But I found myself getting my attention drawn to Dwight Garner rather than Frank Rich at one point. And there I found the most shocking things. My attention was drawn to Dwight Garner as a daily reviewer at the Times, and I became very suspicious of him. He reviewed a book by Rebecca Solnick about disasters and how her thesis was that in disasters, some good comes out of it because people are drawn together and they lose their class distinctions. I didn't read that book, but I very carefully read his review of it, and I found it to be the most insincere of reviews. And I also can't help but think that her thesis is insincere as well. And what clearly triggered that instinct in me is that she wrote about 9/11 as one of those great disasters, like the San Francisco earthquake or the Hurricane Katrina. She treated 9/11 as one of them as well. And it's interesting, in Katrina and in 9/11, we have two of the most politically drenched and significantly imbued disasters, certainly in a century. And the political element in neither one of them was even visible. It was as though muted, as though, that is, of course, I have to say that I'm doing this at one remove, only through Dwight Garner's review. And so I began to explore that. At one point in that chapter, I say, I don't believe either of these writers. I don't think they're telling the truth. In fact, I believe I do say I think they're lying.
What are they lying about?
They're lying. They're either lying by omission, by not mentioning things that they know about Katrina or 9/11. That is to say, the political dimensions, the political causes. I mean, Katrina, there's this piece you can get on the internet still called Steering Katrina and weather management. And also slowness to respond was a political decision. And so New Orleans was essentially destroyed on purpose. And there's not even a hint of that. So that's kind of an omission lie. The other kind of lie would be a more serious lie of omission. If suppose that they had done their homework, as I think they should if they are real writers, they should have studied more about Katrina and more about 9/11. And that would mean that they would have learned about the manipulation of those disasters. But if then they did learn that and didn't mention it, that's an even worse kind of lie of omission. The first kind of lie of omission is just a lie of ignorance. This one is a willful lie of leaving out the important part. I always used to say in classroom, you know, if a half-truth is a lie. This little kid named Jimmy, his parents go out to a movie, and the mother says, Jimmy, stay home and do your algebra tonight. And he says, yes, Mommy dear, I will. So he does three algebra problems, then he goes across the hall and watches dirty movies with Sammy. And he runs home just before his parents get home, and your mother comes in and says, oh, Jimmy, did you stay home and do your algebra problems? And he says, yes, Mommy, I did. Well, is he telling the truth or lying? That's obviously a lie of omission, is it not? And that's what I found in the Dwight Garner piece about Rebecca Solnit. But then Dwight Garner reviewed the Netherlands novel, and I was just astonished. I was shocked to find him saying things like, as I write this piece, back to our real subject, I write, the mind of Dwight Garner, who is either, we're not sure yet, an absolute ignoramus about 9/11, or a high-ranking section director in the Ministry of Truth, that is a hard-working malefactor to his own nation. It's got to be one or the other. He doesn't know anything about it, or if he does, he's lying to us by omission. Now, take this next sentence, this Garnerian sentence for analysis, and here it is. But sorting through the pile of so-called 9/11 novels is a sad exercise, one that grows more pointless by the day. This was written, I believe, in 08 or 09. And so I ask these questions. A sad exercise? And pointless? Why and how could a state such as this conceivably be? If Garner means, however remotely, to associate the word sad with the facts and meaning of line 11, well, one gasps at so grotesque a miscomprehension and diminishment. Certainly he must mean that what's sad is the task of sorting through these novels. But it doesn't seem to be that that's what he means either. He doesn't say whether it's because the books are bad or the books are mediocre, or the books are, you know, shrill. And he says so-called 9/11 novels. And so I ask, well, what's he mean? Does so-called mean poor, dull, inept, hackneyed, or plain old crummy? He doesn't say what he means. And I believe that he doesn't say what he means because he's first either not thinking clearly at all, or he is essentially diminutizing, euphemizing, and sanitizing 9/11. And this through a form of lying by omission. And it's that sanitizing of the lie that's dangerous. That's where the poison comes in.
Describe that a little deeper, if you
yes.
could.
I'll read you a little bit of what he says about these kinds of novels. I call it a childizing or an infantilizing of his audience. And the minute that you think of the subject like 9/11 being something that is the subject for novels, I think you're in trouble. What I say in the book is that he's wrong because there hasn't yet been a 9/11 novel written in the United States. I know of one, and there's a footnote to that effect, but nobody else knows about it. Not enough people. I'll try to make it more widely known. It's called Timing by a fellow named Rand Clifford, and it's quite a book. A pair, it's a novel with a counterpart, a predecessor called Castling. They're both intelligently post 9/11 books, but no one else has written one. They've used 9/11 for cute meat plot devices. They've used 9/11 as background for ominousness or darkness, sort of the way that Tolstoy might have used the Napoleonic invasion of Russia. And these are all, in my view, cheap. And neither do they do what I find is the only one thing that any writer who's serious or any artist who's serious must do, and that is tell the truth. And then am asked the truth about what? And my answer is the truth about existence and the truth about being alive in that state of existence. In other words, all art that's of any significance at all, any durability, any lasting effect or virtue must be about that, about what it means and is to be alive in one's own time. And the moment that anybody sanitizes 9/11 for whatever reasons or in whatever means, they're not telling the truth about what it means or is like to be alive in our state of existence now. And Garner does that. And when he does it, he... Listen to this. He says, it's a real sad exercise looking for 9/11 novels. Well, of course, as I said, there aren't any. And then he writes this interesting thing. It says, well, let's have a look. That's me writing. Here's Garner declaring himself to be waiting not for Godot, but for the great American 9/11 novel, colon. It's impossible, though, to stop scanning the horizon for something else. The bracing, widescreen, many-angled novel that will leave a larger, more definitive intellectual and moral footprint on the new age of terror. Oh, for me, that's something that shouldn't have been written, shouldn't have been thought. Look at, there you are. I ask the reader, are you as appalled and angry as I am? Well, if not, you're lucky because maybe you're not a writer. How about a simple cliche check? Let's, quote, scan the horizon, shall we? And should we have some real literary talk? Hey, let's use words like bracing, widescreen, many-angled to get at the unique and definitive nature of what the genre of the novel really is. Well, dear heaven, that's movie talk, which is to say, in Garner land, that the novel is not only itself a cliché, but it's a derivative one, coming into existence not just by imitating movies, but imitating crappy movies. The bracing, whatever that means, and wide screen, there's a junk metaphor, kind. The many-angled movie, and a larger, yes, bigger is always better in America, kind of TV on the page or movie on the page book that all the publishers in Garnerland most love, meaning generic, user-friendly, empty, tame, and establishment-friendly. If you want to be published as a fiction writer, that's the kind of book you have to write. And so here we are then, minimizing, diminishing, infantilizing the actual nature of 9/11 and the purpose or importance of it. In this new age of terror, he says, Tom Engelhart on Tom Dispatch, there's some writing at the top of that website. It has to do with that sort of phrase, this new age of terror. What are they talking about? I mean, if you really study the events leading up to 9/11, 9/11 itself and the events following 9/11, you'll realize that there is no new age of terror unless it's one that has been created and deployed by the whatever the big powers are that run the West, not by the world of Islam. The wars have been created by us, not by them. It's a little bit like, I suppose, if you had children who are running into the pantry and sipping away at Dad's hooch, his whiskey. Well, what do? You tell the kid, knock it off. That stuff is dangerous. Here's what it'll do to you. Or, if you're like Dwight Garner, you'll say, oh, isn't that nice? That's just water with a funny color. And so the kid will keep nipping away at it and die. Well, I know that's perhaps not an analogy that all will accept, but it is, I think, one very worth thinking about. And if you continue that line of sanitation, diminutizing, and essentially lying by omission or lying by Disneyification, I'm sure there will soon be a musical about 9/11. In fact, somebody once talked about something like that. But in any case, we can sort of sing along while those hideous, treacherous, murderous, treasonous, world-changing crimes are committed. No, I don't want to be part of that. I've concluded a long time ago that American literature is dead. And I have a statement here shortly after the part that we were talking about before regarding Garner. American literature is dead because American thought feeling is dead. And thought feeling for me means that what you have to do as an artist, you have to think, and you have to think a lot and hard. But that thinking has got to be united with the heart in a completely what do you say, a symbiotic way. You can't have a serious artist who is only head, only intellect, and you can't have a serious artist who is only heart or feeling. The importance of art, of all kinds, is its ability to express the nature of being in existence through intellectual feeling or feeling intellect. And so I call it thought feeling. And so without that kind of thought feeling, you can't have art. It'll die. And the reason that American literature is dead is because American thought feeling is dead, and the corpo milito governmento powers visible in Garner's writing are doing and will do everything they possibly can to keep thought feeling dead, to keep everything that has to do with individual conscience, consciousness, and perception in all of America as completely dead can be kept. Those are the wages, not of sin, but the wages of deceit. You lose your ability to see what's real, and you lose any respect for those who can see what's real.
We're at a very interesting time. I don't know what's going to happen, really, especially with the ideas that you present in your book as far as exposing what happened on September 11th, 2001. To have that unravel, can you picture something like that happening?
I think it's going to be convulsive, and it's going to be revolutionary in whatever sense of that word one might choose to think of. And it's also absolutely essential. The patient is dying. The republic is dying. The Constitution is dying. Electoral politics are dead. Elections are dead. We can't long survive. If the United States were a patient, the going would be pretty bad for that patient. They've already lost a liver. They've lost a leg. They've lost an arm. There's a concussion. One lung has been punctured. This patient is barely hanging on. If the nation does hang on purely as a political entity, it may be a most horrifying one that it either a bunch of lobotomized lunkheads forming the population or explicit police state kinds of control being put into place. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe this kind of situation we're in now can limp along for longer than I think. Would you want to be sick for 20 years or alive for 10? It's just a terrible kind of question. Now, the thing about 9/11 itself, it's not so much the cause of anything, it's just the excuse for a lot of very, very criminal stuff that was well in the planning long before 9/11 that we've seen much more visibly applied.
And those types of things, to me, glaring evidence 9/11 was a false flag.
Oh.
And especially with this report that came out called Fear, Inc. I don't know if you heard about that, where the funders that spread the Islamophobia were exposed. Millions and millions of dollars were invested in demonizing Muslims. It was all exposed. Now, these things work together in networks.
Sure.
And you look back at evidence of false flags here and there, and you look at everything else but that.
Yeah, that's a real poser. That's what I wrote about in A Nation Gone Blind. The thesis of that book is that Americans, by the time the year 2006 had come along, long since had stopped seeing things as they are. The book argues, I mean, it takes on quite a number of American writers and shows them not to be able to express themselves well at all. They think they're writing about truth and about the nature of existence inside our life today. And they use words like, you know, I don't know, they use code words, and they think that they're about reality.
We can be manipulated and lied to, and we incorporate that into our daily activities, our daily thinking, our daily lives. But now things are different, and you had a shift in this book as well from the architects and engineers on 9/11 to Dr. Judy Wood's work. And I think that's a critical shift. She has been on In Other News and on other shows on the station. What happened to you with that?
Well, I was a real dummy. I didn't catch on to – I didn't see reality before my eyes on 9/11.
Well, you saw it way before I did.
Oh, well. I saw it once when I read a little Gore Vidal pamphlet, and from there, I continued to read. And at first, I only realized that it was not what it had been said to be. And I had very little idea otherwise. Then when Stephen Jones claimed to have discovered thermite as the cause of the collapses, I thought, oh, he must be right. And I continued reading. And then somebody pointed me toward Dr. Judy Wood.
Before the book?
Oh, yes. Back around 2006. And I began studying her website. And then I began corresponding with her. I saw her not too long ago. I met her in person for the first time. And I said, I can hardly believe that I'm here face-to-face with the most important person in the world. And we laughed, but I meant it. She holds the key to the truth of what happened on 9/11. It's not a matter of argument or debate or rhetoric. She's got scientific evidence, clear and sound, that the towers, and it is shocking. It's a shocking idea for most people. When they hear it, if I'm going to say it now, people, I'm sure, are going to think I'm a nut. But the scientific proof is there in her book, Where Did the Towers Go?, that the towers didn't collapse, they weren't blown up, they didn't burn, they didn't burn down, but they turned into dust. And they were molecularly disassociated. And the means by which that disassociation was made to occur was by directed energy, free direct energy, through free direct energy technology. I think that her book is the most important book. I wrote a foreword to it, and I said it's the most important book of the 21st century. I still do believe it. The argument is over. What happened on 9/11, that argument is over. Who did it and all those other questions aren't answered yet. But they can be answered now that we know what the murder weapon was.
That's why I thought it's critical to have you talk with the listeners here on WBAI about your perception of where we're at today as far as our culture in this realm of lies that we have to engage with every single day.
Mm-hmm.
They have to keep up the charade.
The charade.
We're coming up on the break, Professor Larson. Are you ready to take calls?
Yes, I'd be delighted to take calls.
If you have any questions or comments for Professor Larson, call us at 212-209-2900. We'll be right back after this break. Professor Larson, I wanted to ask you about your website. Can you give that out to listeners and a little bit of a background of how you started your own press?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jeff. I guess I mentioned that in 2006 I brought out A Nation Gone Blind, and the reason for that book's getting written was that I couldn't publish my fiction anymore. So I thought I'd better write a book explaining why I thought that was. It didn't help, however. I still can't publish my fiction, or couldn't. Novels, and so it seemed to me to be time to do something about that. I found a number of other people who weren't able to publish their novels either. I found them as self-published pieces here and there, and they were wonderful. Some of them were just very, very, very fine. And they'd been ostracized by the major mainstreamers too. So we formed a kind of an umbrella, an aesthetic roof over our heads called the Oliver Arts and Open Press.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. And what's that website?
Oh, the website is, the www.oliveropenpress.com.
Oliveropenpress.com, all one word.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go take some calls, and we'll take the first one. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Professor Larson. If you believe now that there's scientific evidence that the towers disassociated by directed energy, were you previously convinced that there was scientific evidence that the collapse was caused by thermite?
That's a very good question. The answer was no, but that I was smitten with the idea that somebody had come up with something. At that time, when was that? Oh, before 06 and 05.
So you said you were smitten with the idea?
Yes, well, absolutely. I mean, it was clear to me that it hadn't been done by airplane fuel or by airplane impact. So I didn't know what it had been done by. And Stephen Jones came up with the theory that it was done by thermite, and to me that was pretty... I didn't know much about thermite. I saw him make very bright, hot lights with it on a demonstration. But it became... As I read and continued to read, it became clear to me that that was a fraudulent approach. His history is one of...
The word sentence seems to suggest that you were persuaded to adopt the conclusion because it was emotionally satisfying to you. And if that's the case about thermite, I wonder if you think that damages your credibility to someone who thinks that you might be similarly smitten and misjudging the accuracy of the evidence in your latest conclusion.
Yeah, I think the difference would be, first, I had a learning curve on my part. It became clear to me that the evidence overall didn't support the thermite argument. And in the case of Dr. Wood's research, she's different from Richard Gage, from Stephen Jones, from Niels Herit, all of the others, because she includes every piece of evidence that is attainable or observable by someone studying the aftermath of 9/11. I heard Richard Gage himself say...
That's a pretty extraordinary claim. She presents every piece of evidence that it's possible to have observed?
Yeah, that is to say that she's able to find, round up, and document. Richard Gage, one of her studies has to do with what she calls toasted cars. And a person asked Richard Gage why he bristles at the very mention of her name, why he didn't take into consideration the effect that the presence of these toasted cars. And he said, well, the reason we don't do that is because it doesn't fall within the range of our idea. Those aren't his exact words. But he's more than once said he just won't consider evidence if it doesn't pertain to his field of concern, which is thermite. And that's like making a decision first and then making the facts fit it. If they don't fit it, you cut them away and ignore them. That's not science. That's charlatanry. Whereas
that's a pretty good definition for what Dr. Wood does.
Oh, I beg your pardon. No, have you read her book?
No, I've looked at her website, but I have not read her book.
Yeah, the book is very, very different from the website.
Why is that?
What's that?
She has evidence, but she doesn't present it on the website. She saved it for the book. Why would she have a website that was misleading compared to her book?
Well, it's not misleading. It's just not as organized as the book is. It's all there. She really despises making people agree. She wants them to think for themselves and see the evidence and conclude through their own process of thinking that the evidence leads you to a conclusion. It should always be so in science. You don't begin with the conclusion and try to fit the evidence to it. You must begin with the evidence, and then it will lead you.
That's exactly what you did when you first supported the thermite theory, because you were smitten with it.
It's okay to acknowledge, caller. It's okay to acknowledge that you made a mistake. You saw something.
I didn't say that it wasn't. But what he's describing other people doing and criticizing him for, he did the same thing himself. And I think that calls into question his credibility, at this juncture, especially when he makes a really extraordinary claim that one researcher has gathered every piece of evidence that it's possible to have.
Well, you want to read the book and see if you can find any evidence that she's left out. I would buy you a beer at the corner bar.
Absolutely. I would, too, actually. It's a 500-page book, 3.5 pounds, 800 photos.
It's a masterpiece.
Does she have... the exact temperature at the World Trade Center site for every moment from the time that the planes struck the tower until the tower collapsed?
No, of course not, but it is one of the fascinating...
She does not have every possible piece of evidence, does she?
I mean, I think there are some pieces of evidence that aren't possible to gain, like, monitoring temperature variations over a period of time when there's that much chaos going on would be sheerly impossible. I think that's asking something impossible of a scientist.
It's possible, every piece of evidence possible. It's not every piece of evidence you could possibly get.
Well, let's not quibble about semantics. She looked into every single aspect that she could find. For example, she alone decided that, if these buildings were said to collapse, they weigh 500,000 tons each, they would really shake the earth a great deal when they fell, yes? Of course. So she went and looked at the seismic records. And discovered that, for example, while it took the towers 11, if they fell, which they didn't, but it took them 11 minutes or seconds to go away, but there were seismic records of movement and shaking in the earth that lasted only 8 seconds.
Every piece of possible evidence.
Well, that's certainly a piece of evidence that...
The fact that she had lots of evidence.
Caller, we have
I'm
other...
Yeah.
We have other callers here, and we want to get to them as well. And I really suggest you have really great questions, and I recommend that you check out her book. Again, you know, two 500,000-ton buildings slammed to the ground. The seismic impact didn't warrant that amount of weight and volume. It didn't crack the bathtub. Debris pile did not match that the buildings that came down. So it goes on and on. It's really worth checking out. So we're going to go to another call. Thank you very much, caller. We appreciate those questions. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm just wondering what your take is on the Occupy Wall Street movement right now. Why are they letting it continue for a week? Why aren't they shutting it down? Is it a threat? Is it not a threat?
I'm probably not a very good person to ask that of. I'm puzzled by, most of all, the absence of protest and organized adversarial moves toward the government's policies and the bank's policies. In my heart, I cheer for them. I was down there Saturday and met a lot of them and spent a good deal of time down there. And if I weren't 70 and I were 30, I'd be much better fit to join them. I don't know if I'd survive one of those arrests with the mace and so on. That's no excuse, but it is simply a fact. My press, the Oliver Arts and Open Press, took 25 books down and with some written, you know, some copy material about the press and about the books, about the authors, and donated them all to the group. So I don't know. I'm hoping there will be more. I hope that it becomes a flashpoint that will encourage others to follow suit. I don't think that ever. That's a big time, and ever. But I don't think that the population of the United States has ever been cheated or criminally offended as seriously as it has been in the last 10, at least 10, and very possibly 15 years.
We're going to go to another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, sir.
All right, great. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling from Long Island, and I've been involved with the truth movement for quite a long time, maybe 7 years. I had a few questions regarding the book and the evidence. My first question is, pools of molten steel were found not a day, not 2 days, not 3 days, not a week, but a month later, pools of molten steel, and this is all documented. Now, how would directed energy create molten steel, number one? And how do you explain the hundreds of witnesses, including New York State employees, such as police officers and firefighters, who claim that there were multiple pre-explosions in World Trade Towers 1 and 2 and in 7? How do you explain that, the explosions and the pools of molten steel? And how does that fit into the directed energy theory? And also, could it be that directed energy was used in conjunction with demolitions and thermite?
Okay.
That's a possibility.
All right, caller, we'll take one at a time.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let's start with the molten steel. I think that I just happened to watch, I guess part of my homework, the new movie put out by architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, the Richard Gage movie. And indeed, there's a whole long string of firemen and first responders saying that they saw with their eyes these streams of molten metal. One did say it was a little stream of molten metal, and the print over took off the word little and just left stream of molten metal. However, immediately upon the cessation of, you know, lethal activity going on Ground Zero at, don't really use that term, but on the site, on 9/11, people walked on the site, and first responders and others draped hydraulic hoses across the site, and nothing happened. They weren't fricasseed. So Judy Wood saw this and wondered what on earth could it mean. And so she looked further for more evidence, and it's fascinating, it's all in the book. But the point is that two things. One, during the entirety of the events of 9/11, there was an absence of high heat. Now, I'm sure that wasn't true during the orange ballooning flames at the tops of the towers, when the, as the Dr. Wood says, when the towers got their holes. I'm sure that was hot, but it wasn't hotter than open fire burning from kerosene. But the remainder of the day, there was not high heat. And the molten metal, that takes us to the next part of your question, or part of your next question, or part of the next part of your question. In any case, there's a very, very wonderful sentence in the book. And it says that things that glow, things that are hot glow, but not everything glows that is hot. Dr. Wood points to something simple like fluorescent bulb. It glows, but it's not hot.
And the steel-toed boots.
And the steel-toed boots, yeah. Well, okay. So there can be melting without heat. And thus the molten metals, if that's what they were, and it does look kind of like they might have been, but they may have been molten through the other element, other physical properties and processes having to do with directed energy. Let me say something about the total boots, though, first. There were lots of reports that the firemen's steel-toed boots were melting, and that was evidence of the great heat underneath the ground.
Or breaking down.
Breaking down, yeah. And Dr. Wood's hypothesis, no, not her. Well, that is, I think, a hypothesis, because she hasn't examined the toed boots. But suspicion is that there's a breaking down of the toes, of the boots, through the process of the directed energy fields. You see, what happened with the towers is that they didn't collapse, they weren't burned, they weren't exploded, they weren't nuked, and they weren't thermited. But they were molecularly disassociated. That is to say, the fields of energy that were focused on them, and then the interfering fields of energy that were passed through the first static fields, have the effect of turning materials, breaking them down, and on a molecular level. It's very, very interesting because there's only something like 2% of the mass of the buildings was left over after the disappearance of them, and much heavy, much dust settled, and other parts of dust flew up into the air, but of the dust that settled, it became thinner and thinner once it was down there, and that's because the disassociation was still continuing, and once it had landed as fairly heavy dust, it began to dissociate and become lighter and lighter. And Dr. Wood has lots of pictures of people walking over the dust, and from around their feet rise up very, very, finer than flour kinds of dust clouds. I can't for the life of me right now, I'm sorry, remember her name for those.
Puffballs,
I guess, that's right. And thank you, Jeff. Showing that the dissociation is continuing. And in fact, this goes into the other question, too, about how they were said to be molten flames for weeks and weeks and weeks under the site. There wasn't. There were 7 sub-basements under the buildings, and none of them was damaged. And none of them was full of molten metal. The PATH trains were still there. The cars were still there. The girders were still there. The Warner Brothers cartoon store was still there.
They were deep. They were deep down below. They weren't affected. But that doesn't prove anything about directed energy.
Oh, yes.
That they were out of harm's way. If you go down deep enough, you're out of harm's way.
Well,
I'm talking about molten steel. I don't know how directed energy creates molten steel. When you have physical proof of thermite, when you have that physical proof, and then you have molten steel, and you can trace the physical proof, what I'm saying, and I'm asking to you, and I appreciate your work, and your candidacy and you coming forward, because I know it's a very hard thing to do, I'm saying to you, you have a theory. Where is the scientific evidence? I have science. I could prove to you right now, too bad I'm not on a show, because I'd bury you in less than 30 seconds.
Well, I don't think you would.
I think you're working for the other side. I honestly think you're working for the CIA. You haven't answered one question, not one.
Wow. Caller, sorry. Well, sorry to disappoint, but we're going to move on here. And if you want to email me at inothernewsradio@yahoo.com, and we'll have you on. And we will have a discussion, and you will see that we're not with the CIA. Okay, we'll go to another call. Hi, you're on
Hello,
the air.
Jeff. Hello, wonderful program as always, Jeff. And thank you to your guest as well. I just wanted to raise the point that 9/11 is something that clearly raises a lot of different suspicions. There are a lot of different theories. No one obviously knows what happens that day. But the fact that people are going this far out to try to figure out what happened that day speaks to the event itself. It seems like there's, an unfortunate, fear of just looking into something that really should be looked into.
That's right. That's
what
right.
happened on that day.
Yes.
We don't understand it, and we should all be trying a lot harder to understand what happened.
That's
that day
the essence of the professor's book. That the Skull of Yorick, I would say.
And, I'm not a scientist myself, but, I do respect scientists, and I do appreciate the concept of a scientific standard and a scientific method. And no scientist is right about every theory that they throw at the wall. That's not how science works. So to try to nitpick and say that one thing is particularly wrong, or, well, maybe one thing is wrong, but one thing about science is that you may be entirely wrong about several things, but entirely right about one key thing. And that's something that another scientist can take to advance the discussion and the research.
Yeah, that does go back to the scientific method, and of course that method is to begin with evidence and allow it or permit it or hope that it may lead you to a conclusion. Richard Gage isn't doing that because he's leaving out most of the evidence. All he's keeping in is the fact that there's thermitic material found in the dust of the Trade Center. And it's not a surprise that there's thermitic dust because the buildings were made of steel and aluminum. And thermite is made out of iron rust and aluminum powder. And as Dr. Wood says in her book, the surprising thing would be if there weren't thermite in the dust of the buildings, since the buildings were made of steel. 99% of steel is iron, and of the aluminum that clad the building. The exterior of the building was aluminum. And in the ruins, the dust has been disassociated, so of course there's going to be a blend available in great quantity of those two substances. And, and furthermore, the presence of the aluminum and the rust in the dust is only one piece of evidence. What about the fact that the seismic signals did not record collapse of 500,000 ton buildings, or that the seven stories below them were unharmed, or that the cement bathtub around the site that held out the waters of the Hudson River from flooding downtown Manhattan wasn't harmed by two 500,000 ton buildings falling down on top of them? In fact, when the whole event was over and heavy cranes were brought to the lip of the bathtub to reach in and remove, There was some stuff left. There were some beams, and there was some debris.
There was a lot of debris.
There was a lot of debris, but it was not 500,000 tons times two worth of debris. It was in the neighborhood. I can't say for sure, but it seems to me that it's in the neighborhood of 2%. In the book, in Dr. Wood's book, she has images showing the proportion of the debris in relation to the mass of the buildings.
I think a great point that Hugh Hamilton has made on the subject is that, that as much as we like to belittle the idea of a conspiracy and a conspiracy theorist, there is also a basic definition of the word, and people do actually conspire to do things. They do it all the time.
Two people planning on what to buy for dinner, they're conspiring.
Yeah, so, the idea of trying to just dismiss things. I mean, the government has their conspiracy theory of what happened that day. I mean, the 9/11, by definition, is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
And, we're going to have to put a lot of theories out there to start dithering away and finally get to something that even resembles the truth. But just to be skeptical and just to say, I don't want to hear any of this, well, it's like, go ahead and, bury your head in the sand.
Yeah.
That's not going to help anything.
Won't help. You're right.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Caller, thank you very much. We're going to go to another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hi,
great show. I wish we had more time. A couple of quick points. One is some people said that the bodies that were falling actually vaporized and disintegrated into nothing. Could that be part of this? And the most important thing, how is this free energy? Where was it directed from? And you guys didn't even explain exactly what source or how did they actually direct this energy there.
I think maybe Jeff wants to say something about one of those questions.
On the jumpers, the chapter on the jumpers, Dr. Wood had mentioned that they were hanging out the window and taking their clothes off, and she suspects that their clothes were wet either by the sprinklers or they poured water on themselves from the bathroom because of the heat. She also points out that a paper towel in a microwave doesn't do anything, but if it's wet, then it starts to cook. And she suspects that in the center of the buildings, it was starting to cook. And some of these jumpers may have been, like, cooking already. And so they didn't land and bounce. It was another, something else happened. They sort of broke apart. But also the jumpers may not have jumped and may have been pushed out because of the distance away from the building. Anyway, so it goes on and on. Her powers of observation were really, really sharp in that chapter, and it really is a fascinating read.
Pushed not by other people, but pushed by the impetus of... Dr. Wood uses an example of suppose you're in a kitchen talking and not paying attention, and you rest your hand on a hot burner on a stove top. You don't do anything except move your hand. There's no thought process. There's no absence. There's no hesitation. There's no time lapse between the burning and the removal of the hand. And she uses that that chapter is more descriptive than conclusive. She's not making any claims beyond what she's describing. But I think it's one of the most passionately done chapters, chapter 3. I think there may be more on that subject to come.
Caller, we've run out of time. I want to thank our guest, Professor Eric Larson. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy I could be.
The Skull of Yorick, The Emptiness of American Thinking at a Time of Great Peril, Studies in the Cover-Up of 9/11. That is Oliver Open Press at oliveropenpress.com. And we'll see you next week.
I'm leaving my night. I'm leaving alone. I'm leaving it lie.
We just heard an important past interview with Professor Eric Larson from September of 2011. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guest.
With changing your mind, you haven't got the grace to say you finally decide, and you haven't got the strength to stay to fight. Those people who surround you only want to see you weak enough to crawl. Then life you decide for you and buy up all your rights and all your wrongs. And they're trying to stop you singing in the middle of your song. For they do not want you free and they will not make you strong, but only drag you down in the hole they're coming from. They say